G for the world.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. This week on the Lawyers Guild Show, and hi, Maria, how are you?
Hi, I am good. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you now loud and clear. Good to see
Excellent.
You. Good to hear from you.
Excellent.
We have a little Zoom going here, folks, so we can see one another. And Maria looks wonderful and sharp as a tack. All right, this week on the Lawyers Guild Show, it's again time to spend the hour reviewing the more important court cases and legal developments of the past couple of weeks. Indeed, today, just today, this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on the right of President Trump to, well, deprive Congress of its right to set U.S. tariff rates. In addition, we're going to be discussing the fact that more than 100 judges have now ruled against the Trump administration's mandatory immigration detention policy. We're going to take a look at the legality of Trump's military assault on ships from Venezuela that are allegedly carrying drugs, discuss what the courts and Trump are saying about the now expired federal SNAP food benefits. Will people be getting those benefits? And learn as well, here on the National Lawyers Guild Show, why a member of Congress has asked the Department of Justice to investigate the National Lawyers Guild itself. So there is lots to cover, and as usual for these shows, our guest is Stephen Rohde. Now, Mr. Rohde is a prolific author of two books and scores of articles and book reviews on constitutional law and history. He's the former president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and is a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Mr. Rohde is also the host of the new podcast, Speaking Freely, produced by MS Studios, which is available on Spotify. That's Ms. Studios for Steve's benefit. iHeartRadio and other streaming platforms are carrying it. I should mention that Mr. Rohde is also, along with Maria Hall and myself, a host of the national public affairs show called Law and Disorder. Yeah, there's a national show that all of us take turns being a host of. Law and Disorder, it's called. It's now airing in close to 200 radio markets nationwide. You can go to lawanddisorder.org, find all the old shows, the new shows, learn what's going on. It's a similar show to this show, but we often have guests that aren't available for this show. So you want to check it out, my friends. Well, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Law and a Lawyers Guild show.
Thank you so much, Jim and Maria. It's a real pleasure to always join you for these important discussions.
Steve, today the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on whether it's within the purview of the President of the United States to himself set the rate of U.S. tariffs out some specific statute from the Congress authorizing him to do so, or whether that's a right otherwise reserved to Congress. What can you tell us about today's arguments in the high court? Can you give us any clue as to which way the court might be leaning?
Well, Jim and Maria, November 4 and 5, when the history books are written, may well be cited as the beginning of the end of the Trump autocratic imperial presidency. At the end of the show, we'll talk about yesterday's electoral victories around the country. But this morning, the United States Supreme Court signaled, and it's always dangerous to predict from an oral argument in the Supreme Court what their ultimate decision will be. But in the last few hours, many commentators are seeing the possibility that a majority on the Supreme Court will find Donald Trump's tariffs against almost 100 countries to be unlawful under federal law. These cases, there are several cases which were combined for oral argument today, have been working their way up to the court. I like the title of the main case, Learning Resources versus Trump, because he's in such need of learning resources. That was a publisher that was severely impacted by the tariffs. Now, the problem for the Supreme Court is they have built up doctrines which they have tried to use in the past, which now may come back to haunt them if they are going to show any consistency and integrity. Congress has the power under the Constitution to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. That is exclusively a congressional power. And instead, Trump has been imposing tariffs. Now, I actually believe that initially, at least, Donald Trump didn't understand tariffs. He thought that tariffs were paid by foreign governments. Tariffs are paid by the U.S. importers, and those costs are then passed on to U.S. consumers. So he went forward with all of that, but now this court will judge whether he exceeded the powers of the Constitution that are exclusively assigned to Congress. Now, that was the state of affairs for 150 years, but in 1977, Jimmy Carter signed the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which was actually meant to limit presidents' reliance on invoking emergency powers, claiming implicit powers that did not elsewhere exist. So it was actually a law limiting the president, but now the president's lawyers are invoking that law to claim that it constitutes congressional permission to allow him to invoke these tariffs. Now, these conservative justices not only face those stumbling blocks, but they invented a theory called the Major Questions Doctrine. They invented it to block President Biden when he was using executive authority to have student loan forgiveness or efforts to address climate change. And they said the president couldn't do that, couldn't take on powers like that when a major question existed, and they were very facile in finding major questions when it impinged on Joe Biden's powers. And finally, something called the non-delegation doctrine, which was used during FDR's administration by a conservative Supreme Court to cut back on his executive powers. Well, the conservative faced all of that this morning. It was a three-hour oral argument. And reading the tea leaves, Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch were the most hostile toward Trump's lawyers and his Solicitor General, D. John Sauer. Amy Coney Barrett asked, what emergency? Does every country pose a threat to the defense and industrial base of the United States, Spain, France, etc.? All the justices pointed out that Trump is the first president in 50 years to rely on that 1977 law. And even Justice Roberts cited the power to tax as a core congressional authority. And of course, we can always rely on the three liberals. Justice Sotomayor said, you want to say tariffs are not taxes, but that's exactly what they are. They are generating money from American citizens. So three lower courts have found Trump's tariffs unconstitutional and illegal. This could be a major blow to the cornerstone of his administration. And I frankly am announcing today that I am holding some hope that at least five and maybe more justices will strike down his tariffs.
Yeah, but I share that. I read and had that same impression from the arguments. But I'm wondering, the New York Times made the point that even if the case goes the way you've suggested it goes, that there are other laws on the books that with sufficient specificity do provide Trump with a basis for imposing tariffs. I don't know if we have time or you want to talk about that today or not, but...
Well, just briefly, that is true. Those are much narrower and specific on a country-by-country basis. It would force him to jump through hoops. And you're right, I don't put it past him to do anything to try to keep a grip on these tariffs, because it's only the tariffs that have provided the income to justify his tax cuts and everything else he's doing.
Well, Steve, millions of Americans have now lost SNAP food assistance benefits. I understand at least two judges have ruled Trump must use these supplemental funds to continue the program during the government shutdown. What's the status right now?
Well, this is another example of the cruelty of Trump's policies in the last 10 months. We've seen how cruel he has been toward immigrants, but there's no limit to his cruelty. And now he has suspended food assistance for 42 million Americans. Now, as you say, two judges have issued rulings in Massachusetts and Rhode Island that the freeze on benefits must be lifted, and that the executive branch must use Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that's SNAP, and that there is available a contingency fund of $6 billion to pay for at least a portion of the roughly $8 billion that was meant to be dispersed this month. The judge in Rhode Island, John McConnell, an Obama appointee, said, quote, "There's no doubt that the $6 billion in contingency funds are appropriated funds that are without a doubt necessary to carry out the program's operation," and he ordered the Trump to do so. Now, in the last 48 hours or so, Trump has been flip-flopping. There were indications that the DOJ would not appeal these two court rulings. He has been off again, on again, saying there would be partial payments that would be issued. They may have already lost a cycle. People expected these checks automatically paid to their bank accounts on November 1st.
Yes.
So we're just going to have to watch this very carefully. And these judges seem ready to call out the Trump administration if it actually defies their court orders, which it's been doing elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Steve, let's talk about an article Politico reported. Politico reported that there have now been more than 100 judges. That figure really surprised me. There have now been more than 100 judges that have ruled against the Trump administration's policy of mandatorily detaining apprehended immigrants sought for deportation without benefit of a hearing. Talk to us about that.
This is a very important comprehensive study that Politico did in an article by Kyle Cheney that was published on October 31st. People can go to Politico to see it. They did the hard work of digging into these cases. I'm told now that upwards of 480 or more lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration across the board, and that over 200 injunctions and restraining orders and final judgments have been issued against him. Of those rulings, these 100 federal judges, in particular cases, have ordered ICE to use the policy that existed for decades, going back to Ronald Reagan, that you do not deport a person who is in the United States and is pending their administrative review. Now, what's so important about this analysis is that it confronted the fact that since July 8, ICE reversed that 30-year practice and determined that ICE could lock up everyone facing deportation, even if they've lived in the country for decades and have no criminal record. Courts around the country, one judge said, have since rejected the government's new interpretation. That was the statement of U.S. District Judge Kyle Dudek, a Florida-based Trump appointee, last Wednesday, saying this court now joins that consensus. Other Trump-appointed judges have ruled against the administration, including a judge, a federal judge in Louisiana, another one in Minnesota, another in Indiana, and another in Texas. That Texas judge ruled on October 21st that one ICE detainee who had been held without any individualized assessment of his dangerousness was deprived of his constitutional due process rights. Now, because the Supreme Court had struck down or had stayed national injunctions, these cases have had to be litigated case by case in large part. In one case, fortunately, Judge Patty Saris, a Clinton appointee, approved a statewide class for immigrants in Massachusetts who were subject to this mandatory detention policy. So these judges are consistent. 12 of them are Trump appointees, 12 are George W. Bush appointees, one is a George H.W. Bush appointee, and two are Reagan appointees, and the rest were appointed by Democrats. What it does is it demonstrates that intelligent judges across the country are analyzing the law and coming up with these rulings. To conclude, one judge, Richard Boulware, said the overwhelming majority of district courts across the country, including this court, that have considered the Trump administration's new statutory interpretation have found it incorrect and unlawful. We're hopeful those rulings are upheld in the appellate courts, and then, of course, it'll end up in the Supreme Court.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, Steve, talk to us as well about the case of Stand With Us versus MIT, which has to do with the idea that, well, if one dares to speak out against Israeli Zionism, that one has thereby issued an anti-Semitic slur.
This is a very important case. On this show, we have discussed the dangerous concept that has been spreading across the country, which is the conflation of criticism of Israel and their genocide in Gaza and occupation of the West Bank, the conflation of that with virulent, hateful anti-Semitism. On our last show, I believe, we talked about a very strong judge in Boston, in the Harvard case, who called out that principle and said that it was improper for the Trump administration to be withholding research funds in the name of combating anti-Semitism when what they were combating was protests on campus and the responses of students and faculty. Well, now we have the case of Stand With Us versus MIT. Stand With Us is a strident pro-Israel organization. It sued MIT under a theory that MIT was failing to adequately monitor and discipline discrimination under Title VI. And the court clearly, in a long and comprehensive opinion, which I think will withstand appellate review, and frankly, given the fact that sometimes the conservative justices on the Supreme Court recognize the limits that the First Amendment places on our legal system, that they may well reaffirm this. The court found, they reaffirmed that hostile environment liability of any type, including on a college campus, is constrained by the First Amendment. No law can violate the First Amendment. And that hostile environment theories cannot be used to compel the suppression of protected political speech on matters of public concern. The court found that anti-Zionism is, as a matter of law, not inherently anti-Semitic, that it has many definitions, that it can be viewed as a political ideology, and that it is protected under the Constitution, and that harassment is only severe, pervasive, objectively offensive conduct that causes a systematic deprivation of access to education. It's a very comprehensive opinion, and this is at the appellate level now. It had already been found at the district level. This was the First Circuit with an Obama judge, a Biden-appointed judge, but also a George W. Bush judge, especially appointed from the district court. The conduct, the rallies that were held, the calling out from the river to the sea, or intifada, were protected political speech. This is something we've been saying on this show. I've been writing it extensively. But what's important about this case is by systematically marching through how the First Amendment is at the top of the constitutional order, that what students said in chanted signs, emails, and posts were constitutionally protected, and that such speech receives special protection and cannot be suppressed merely because others find it offensive or upsetting. There's more extensive analysis of that case, and in particular that anti-Zionism is not per se anti-Semitism, and that the wide debate over anti-Zionism does not allow a court to arm either side of that debate with the powers of a censor. Mm-hmm. I'm pleased to have seen such a scholarly, thoughtful opinion coming out of a court of appeals, and I'm very hopeful it will be upheld even by the conservatives on the Supreme Court.
Indeed, indeed.
Well, Steve, another case raising First Amendment issues concerns an ICE-detained journalist, Sami Hamdi. What can you tell us about this case?
Well, this is shocking, but can we still be shocked anymore by this administration? Sami Hamdi is a prominent Middle Eastern journalist who has spoken widely. Earlier last week, he spoke at Golden State Annex. No, I'm sorry, that's where he was detained. He was speaking at a Sacramento public discourse, and yet he was seized by federal ICE officers. He was taken into custody at that Golden State Annex. And immediately, his attorneys filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus and an emergency temporary restraining order seeking to block his transfer and eventually secure his release. Well, fortunately, the court granted a order blocking ICE from transferring this journalist out of California. This was a favored technique by ICE to immediately arrest, detain, and then move these individuals often to a jurisdiction which they believe would be more favorable to ICE and to Trump. So the first order of business was to block them from transferring this British journalist, Sami Hamdi. Now his very capable lawyers are moving ahead to challenge his case. All this man is doing is exercising his free speech rights to write about and lecture and talk about Muslim civil liberties and what is happening in Israel and Palestine. It is a pure example of speech, and he was in the country when he was seized, and that underlines the principle we've discussed before, that every person in the United States, not just every citizen in the United States, every person enjoys the full panoply of First Amendment rights, of free speech, free press, and all the rest. It is shocking that ICE and the Trump administration has gone so far as to seize a journalist. And fortunately, at the first level, this judge has insisted he remain in California, and literally within the next days or week, we will hear a further ruling that the underlying case itself is a violation of the First Amendment.
Well, Steve, the Trump administration, moving on, has told Congress that there is no law that prohibits Trump from ordering the U.S. military to conduct strikes against those small boats from Venezuela that are allegedly carrying drugs. But what about the Congressional War Powers Resolution and the requirement? I mean, can a president really just decide it's going to wage acts of war whenever it suits his fancy?
Well, that's what he and his handpicked lawyers are saying. This issue, I think, is not getting the attention it deserves, because our country, in the grip of this commander-in-chief, as far as we know by now, has assassinated 65 people.
Yes.
Across 15 airstrikes on boats in both the Caribbean Sea and the Eastern Pacific. And we know they are calling up the Navy and threatening the country of Venezuela. This is the most overwhelming authority that a president has or exercises, using the direct military force of the United States government to kill people. These are extrajudicial killings, meaning that there has been no court. They easily could have arrested and detained these individuals. They could have surrounded their small fishing boats if they claim they are engaging in smuggling drugs at sea, and then they could have brought them up on charges and given them the due process that international law requires. They skipped all that. They acted like the most overbearing totalitarian government can act, which is the direct killing of people who are presumed innocent. Now, to justify all that, the Justice Department and its Office of Legal Counsel, an individual named T. Elliot Gaser, issued a statement and went to Congress last week asserting that President Trump could lawfully continue his lethal military strikes on people suspected of smuggling drugs at sea, notwithstanding a time limit for congressionally unauthorized deployments of armed forces into, quote, hostilities. Now, I want to quickly preview that in doing so, Trump's lawyers are citing precedents under Democratic presidents and others in the past. We have suffered a sleepwalking in this nation for decades when it comes to the fact that the Constitution provides that Congress shall declare war. And various administrations, I'll mention a few examples in a moment, have tied the law in knots to advance whatever their particular foreign policy agenda was at the time. And now we are reaping the sad benefits of that by one of the most overbearing uses of military force in this case. Now, we have to understand that the War Powers Resolution was adopted in 1973. It was in some reaction after the Vietnam War that decades of presidents from both parties had been using large standing armies left in place after World War II to send troops into combat without congressional authorization. Now, the War Powers Act set up a system in which the president had to advise the Congress of the use of any hostilities, military force, and that such hostilities would terminate after 60 days if Congress had not authorized it by then. In this case, Trump has been up to this since September 4, 60 days expired on Monday, November 5, mm-hmm. And Congress has not authorized these military actions. Now, what
Steve, I wonder if I can interrupt you just for a moment.
Yes.
We are drifting a little over the time for station ID.
Yes, so of course.
Hold those next thought. We will take what I'm sure will be a brief station ID, and we'll be right back with you, folks.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
And we are back with you as promised. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild show here on KPFK. I'm Jim Lafferty along with my co-host Maria Hall. And our guest today is Steve Rohde, because we are once again reviewing many of the court decisions, the more critical court decisions of the last couple of weeks and related matters thereto. I'm sorry, Steve, but we had to interrupt you there for a moment. Carry on with your answer to your last question.
No problem. So to catch people up, we're looking at the fact that Trump has so far, that we know, killed almost 65 people in 15 airstrikes around the world. Now, the way his lawyers are trying to get around the War Powers Resolution is to say that we are not conducting and are not involved in, quote, hostilities. Now, it seems pretty hostile to kill 65 people in 15 separate airstrikes. The way they get to this is they say American service members are not in danger. It's not a hostility, because we're just doing all the killing and the American servicemen are not in danger. Because by and large, the boats suspected of smuggling drugs were struck by drones, which are operated off of naval ships carrying U.S. forces far from the detonation site. So this is the drone exception. Now, I think this has a far broader concerns, and many of us have examined the emerging use of drones in American and other wars, frankly. We have, if it's the right phrase, outsourced our wars by having servicemen sit in the desert in Nevada with sophisticated instruments controlling drones and committing the same kind of travesties that wars commit, from hand-to-hand combat, let alone other military force. It is very dangerous if we go down the road, because if it's no longer war, if it's no longer military hostilities, to conduct a disproportionate war where one side is safe at a distance and is only killing the other side, we are into a brave new world in the use and implication of war. But that's exactly what the Trump lawyers are arguing. They claim that the operations comprise precise strikes conducted largely by unmanned aerial vehicles launched from naval vessels in international waters at distances too far away from the crews of the targeted vessels to endanger American personnel. Now, what I already previewed is that other presidents have toyed with these kinds of arguments in the past, and some of those opinions are going to come back to haunt peace-loving people. The Office of Legal Counsel has issued two opinions discussing this military deployment issue, one from a Republican administration and one from a Democratic one. In 1984, the memo contained a paragraph discussing what hostilities might mean, but it didn't quite take a position one way or the other. It observed a House report where the War Powers Resolution was said that term could be interpreted to encompass a danger of armed conflict, not just combat. Well, that would favor the notion that there is danger of armed conflict when you start doing what the Trump administration is doing if any country were to retaliate. It also noted that the Ford administration had argued that hostilities referred to a situation in which U.S. armed forces were actively engaged in exchange of fire. So Trump's lawyers are citing that. In 1994, 10 years later, there was a memo about President Bill Clinton's authority to unilaterally deploy peacekeeping troops to Haiti. It didn't discuss the war powers limitation. Now, there is the Obama-era Libya precedent, which did not lead to an opinion, but there was a division of authority in Obama's administration. Some in his team argue that the war in Libya did not constitute hostilities based on more than the idea there was little risk of U.S. casualties because there were no ground troops. Others on his team disagreed with that. Consequently, those precedents sit on the books. President Nixon vetoed the War Powers Resolution, but with a bipartisan vote, he said it was an unconstitutional intrusion on his authority as Commander-in-Chief. Well, we've heard that before. Congress overrode his veto with bipartisan support, and it came into effect. Every subsequent president since Nixon has exceeded the limit, treating the provision as too narrow to be constitutional, and Congress has largely acquiesced in that. And that's probably my final point on this topic, is the utter inactivity of Congress, that no hearings have been called by the majority party in either the Congress or the Senate to examination what our government is doing in killing these people. It's one terrible example of the impotence of the passivity, and it's even more than that, because it's also enabling Trump when they pass the big, beautiful bill and they are shutting down the government. So, but I do think this one has to cause peace-loving people who stand by the rule of law and international law to take note that Democratic presidents have breached this War Powers Act, that they've made arguments that they're not causing hostilities. So this one will take some soul searching. And if we ever get back to any normalcy in our federal government, we're going to have to ask, don't we need stronger congressional powers to be exercised when it comes to the most powerful instrument of war? And could this example, having brought it to the American people, be an impetus to restrict future presidents from exercising this kind of lethal assault without the thoughtful consideration by Congress and the American people?
Indeed, indeed. Indeed, indeed, Steve. Thank you for that. Yes.
Yes. Well, Steve, I wanted to mention another interesting article in Politico that addresses the question of Lindsay Halligan, attorney Lindsay Halligan's efforts to prosecute Trump's foes. The article refers to some warning signs in this regard. Talk to us about these warning signs when somebody with political power then goes after their political, at least people who they consider their political enemies.
So let's learn who the players are. I don't know that everyone has considers it a household name yet of Lindsay Halligan, but I think we have to know who she is. She was a personal lawyer to Donald Trump. She had no federal criminal experience in the past. She's a pure loyalist to Trump. And when the U.S. Attorney's Office was considering investigating James Comey for lying to Congress and Letitia James for allegedly lying on a real estate form, the rank and file, the career prosecutors, in particular with respect to the Comey case, because that's been documented, were simply not prepared to indict former FBI director James Comey. So when someone's not doing Donald Trump's bidding, they get fired. And that U.S. attorney was fired and replaced by Lindsay Halligan. She personally signed these indictments against Comey and James. But meanwhile, across the country, the question of these loyalist U.S. attorneys who are interim and serve without Senate approval, and the serious question has been raised by three federal courts in New Jersey, Nevada, and California. All of those separate judges have ruled that the maneuvers by the Justice Department to appoint unvetted, unapproved Trump prosecutors violated federal law. And these rulings are a prelude to the potential disqualification of these attorneys general, of these U.S. attorneys, and of Lindsay Halligan. So what we know is that in the other cases, they are ordering those U.S. attorneys to be disqualified, and that puts in question the indictments in those various jurisdictions in New Jersey, Nevada, and California, whether those indictments can go forward. Now, some of the judges in those cases have found that those indictments also were signed by other career U.S. attorneys. And so while the Trump unvetted prosecutors are being removed, the prosecutions they've initiated may not be dismissed. However, in the Halligan case, literally Lindsey Halligan signed the indictments of Comey and James by herself. In one case, a memo was left behind that the career prosecutors in the Eastern District of Virginia, where all of this is happening, had resisted bringing those cases. Of course, critics have rightfully described them as political retribution, noting that that Trump had vowed revenge against Comey and James for their involvement in previous investigations into him. If Halligan's appointment is deemed invalid, there's a serious question now whether the indictments of Comey and James may be stricken because she's the only one who signed the indictments. Some speculate that there may be superseding indictments signed by other judges, by other lawyers. So we're not sure where that's going to shake out. But what's important is, first of all, in another area of law, judges are doing their job and following their duty. They are hearing these arguments. There will be an argument in Hallinan's case later this month, and we will have to see whether or not it will affect those prosecutions. Meanwhile, I'll quickly note, because it was in the news today, that a judge in the Comey case questioned a federal lawyer, saying it seems like the Trump DOJ is following the adage, indict first, investigate later. And they are trying to get the documents produced, which the government has a duty to produce all exculpatory evidence. And of course, Trump's lawyers have been dragging their feet. So there may be many grounds, as well as selective enforcement and selective prosecution, when it comes to these cases against Comey and James, above and beyond Lindsey Halligan's questionable status.
Absolutely, absolutely. We can expect it, I think. Well, then there's the matter that is about as close to home as you can get. And I'm thinking of the fact that the Republican member of Congress from Texas, Representative Lance Gooden, has sent a letter to Attorney General Bondi at the U.S. Justice Department about the National Lawyers Guild and its affiliate chapters and entities. It makes some pretty outrageous claims against the Lawyers Guild and demands that the Department of Justice investigate those claims and take appropriate action at the close of the investigation. Talk to us about this, Steve.
This is dangerous. You know, I've alluded to the famous Martin Niemöller poem, you know, first they came for the communists, then they came for the trade unionists, then they came for the Jews, and no one was left to speak up. Well, you know, first they've come for everybody else. They've come for immigrants and detainees and foreign students, and now they're coming after the National Lawyers Guild. I emphasize this and wanted to talk about it today because it humanizes, it personalizes these attacks. It means, along with attacks on the Open Society, George Soros's organization, Indivisible, Act Blue, Jewish Voice for Peace, this administration is unrestrained in its willingness to go after its perceived enemies. And we just saw that with the indictments of James Comey and Letitia James. So on October 16, Lance Gooden, a Democrat from Texas, wrote a three-page letter.
Actually a Republican member, I think.
I'm sorry, I was looking at district and read it as Democrat. Republican Representative Lance Gooden. And the letter has the weight, this is serious. A member of Congress can call upon the Attorney General of the United States to instigate an investigation. It's one of their powers, and by and large, and certainly in the case of Pam Bondi, this request is going to be taken seriously. But I want you to hear some of the language of the letter, how an oppressive party moves against those who are trying to fight for justice and equality, like the National Lawyers Guild has done since its founding and does every day. Right off the bat, and the weight of the letter, how they make normal conduct sinister and criminal. He writes, because of reported involvement in the recent Antifa-linked violence riots in major cities across the country, the National Lawyers Guild and its network maintain close ties with left-wing extremists and domestic terrorist organizations like Antifa. The nexus between the NLG, Antifa, and any other entity involved in perpetuating violent unrest must be investigated and met with appropriate action. Now, we've got to pause here to take a moment on Antifa. Mm-hmm. Antifa is not an organization. In fact, given some of its anarchist roots, they wouldn't want to be an organization. Antifa is anti-fascist. Trump and his ilk love to take terms and torture and conceal their real meaning. He did that to woke. Woke was the concept, I believe, traces all the way back to a speech by Martin Luther King, that we must awaken to racism and the continuation of the badges of slavery and segregation in this country. We must be woke to that. And DEI, which we've talked about on this radio show, that conceals those initials, mean diversity, equity, and inclusion. So Antifa is anti-fascist. And I have stood in public meetings recently and announced that I am Antifa. I am anti-fascist. And I join a long list of anti-fascists in their time, going back to Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony and others that we could list endlessly. Those are the people in their times, whatever the term for the oppressor was, that were anti-fascist. So this letter goes on to say that the National Lawyers Guild was founded in 1937 with the stated goal of protecting workers, defending human rights, and fighting fascist oppression, but has since been taken over by radical left-wing and communist organizations and causes. Oh, the NLG's affiliation with violent extremism has grown and is actively involved in campaigns against measures aimed at maintaining peace and law and order. This includes demanding the abolishment of prisons and opposing higher penalties for masked rioters who attack people for exercising their constitutional rights. The letter goes on, since openly aligning itself with Antifa's disruptive and violent practices in 2017, the NLG, and listen to this, the NLG has provided legal assistance.
Oh my goodness.
To let violent offenders go free, most notably during the 2020 Black Lives Matter riots. Trump has designated Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization. You know, he did that with a strike of a Sharpie, with the intent of, he believes, Antifa has the intent of overthrowing the government. And despite that designation, despite Trump calling it a domestic terrorist organization, the NLG had the audacity, that's my word, to maintain close ties with Antifa and has been actively offering assistance and advice to avoid law enforcement. The NLG assists left-wing extremists engaged in violence and destruction of public property while still enjoying significant tax breaks, subsidies, and benefits. Here's the rub. The NLG is part of a network of the National Lawyers Guild Foundation, the National Immigration Project, the Mass Defense Project, and the National Police Accountability Project, which are registered nonprofits. So this Republican congressperson wants an investigation into the NLG network, into its direct ties with Antifa terrorists, perpetuating and perpetrating violence. And this is just a question now from the congressperson, the foreign government involvement with the NLG. And if there's unlawful activity, then the Department of Justice and all relevant agencies must move against the NLG, including disbarment of its members, revocation of its 501 status, and bringing criminal charges as the administration deems necessary and appropriate. Well, that's as full a Red Scare type McCarthyite. I hope listeners are hearing the echoes of when this government went after communists and fellow travelers and others, and you can see it going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And, it's part of a national campaign to especially get rid of 501c tax-exempt status for organizations like the National Lawyers Guild Foundation, because that's where people can make donations which are tax-exempt. And those organizations don't engage in political work. The foundation does not engage in political work. The Lawyers Guild itself is a bar association, which represents people to protect their constitutional rights. It's just that simple. We're not members of other organizations as such. Well, in a couple of minutes that we have left, and I think we do just have a couple of minutes.
Just about 90 seconds, yes. We definitely want to get on to the elections and Prop 50. And I know you just published an article in Ms. Magazine about Prop 50. So please tell us. Tell us more.
Yes. Late last night, I published Prop 50's resounding victory shows activism can be transformed into voting. That's up on the Ms. Magazine website. I'm proud of what people around this country did yesterday. We have said there are different pillars in this resistance. There is the outspoken protests we're all engaged in. There are the lawsuits and litigation, and there is voting. And I believe yesterday we flexed our muscles. We moved from the No King's Day rallies and protests into organizing, canvassing, get out the vote. I think it's a precursor for the midterms, and it is a sign that we are a movement that will not accept this authoritarian regime, that we will blunt it next year by taking control of Congress, and we will cast it into the dustbin of history in 2028.
Well, thank you for that, Steve. Thank you so much for that. I think we are now sadly out of time. Steve Rohde, as always, we thank you so much for doing this for us so often, and we do really appreciate it. How can people follow your work? Well, whoops, I'm sorry. I announced that at the beginning. I'm going to have to simply say now, hearing that music being played, that we thank all of you for listening today. We urge all of you to stay healthy and to stay active, my friends. We'll be back with you again next week at the same time, same place. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me.
earth.
Support comes from the Soraya, presenting Maritza, performing for one night only on November 6th. The acclaimed Portuguese fado singer blends jazz, flamenco, and more into the soulful and poetic nature of traditional Portuguese fado music. Maritza's enchanting charisma and unparalleled voice will take you on a